So, are there any questions?
Very calm. The Kennedy round of tariff and government interests. They recognize that foreign powers have tariffs, inhibiting people doing business together. And so through some sort of person acts, trying to get those brought down. But they've caused problems in Sharma.
No, let me state the more general proposition so I don't have to wed myself to a particular history which I may not understand, okay? Which is the question of whether or not you think the justification for tariffs in a particular case is to offset tariffs that have been running in the opposite direction, right? That is, what you're trying to do is use them as a strategic weapon. Couple of points about it. One, as a theoretical matter, this at least might have the justification that the long-term intentions are to create open markets in both directions. So at least what it does is it admits the provision of international trade, comparative advantage, voluntary exchange, and the whole thing. To that extent, it seems to me that it is reasonably well-intentioned. But I think in the end, over the years, I've become persuaded that it's utterly perverse in terms of the way in which it operates in practice. First of all, it turns out that it's an enormous battle to decide whether or not the other fellow has a tariff or a restriction that's in place, and if so, whether it's unfair. To give you but one illustration, is an inspection law at the border to be treated as though it is a disguised tariff on the one hand or a safety statute on the other? And in order to answer that question, you have to decide whether or not it discriminates between local and foreign produce. But in order to answer the question of whether or not there's discrimination, you have to decide whether or not other forms of inspection at the plant are equal in the two countries. So by the time you go through all of this, you never know whether you're in a position where you're retaliating on the one hand or whether you're initiating on the other. Well, of course, when it comes to the second round of that, they will say, our things were legitimate inspection rules. Your thing is a wretched tariff. Therefore, we're retaliating against you. You're not retaliating against us. And so what happens is, instead of having this as a simply a two-period game, bad guy over here, good guy over there, you have bad guy, bad guy, bad guy, bad guy, bad guy. And everybody has a different characterization of the events, and you're trying now to unravel a series of disputes that you can never get there. Okay. The second point that makes it crazy is that even if you were right that there was some sort of an offense, you would then want to say that you have to be able to get the remedy proportionate to the offense in question. And of course, you could never do that. The things that happen are in several ways. Even if you decided that there was an infraction, you have to decide what the seriousness of the offense is before you could figure out what the sanctions are going to be. And well, suppose it turns out that, to take a typical illustration, we have Japanese tariffs on American automobiles being sent over there, but we're such great marketing wizards that we only send them with left side drive, when in fact they drive on the right side of the road. Well, the question is, why didn't they buy our cars? And you now have to estimate which percentage of lost sales is attributable to the fact that we're marketing morons, and which percent is attributable to the fact that they are basically devils with respect to the import business. Once you start having arguments over that, then you're back to the same soup again. Secondly, whom are you going to retaliate against? It's as not as though when you look at this thing, you can retaliate against countries. Remember, there are individual firms and individual individuals within both of these countries. And what typically happens is the retaliation is not against the industry which did the wrong, but against some other industry which is relatively innocent of all the mechanization. And therefore, what happens is that you now bring into the play a political battle in which you got two sets of bad guys on the other side, the one who was the scoundrel to begin with and the other fellow who's been gored by your rather ill-aimed arrow. And once you realize that, you understand that once you go down this particular road and put it into the hands of my learned profession and the economic witnesses that we could hire, you could make anything that is done by any government into an occasion for a war-caused celebrity. So the appropriate response, given the fact that we can never make good on this ostensible program of we're going to retaliate in order to eliminate, is unilateral disarmament. Or as Milton Friedman said when this issue came up years ago and I heard him speak about it, he gave a much shorter answer, which is why he's such a better speaker. He said, look, there's a hole in the bottom of the boat. The cure is not to blow another one in, and the ship will just sink faster. That was Milton's answer. And I guess it makes more sense than mine, okay? So, all right, So you've given the usual convoluted answer. Why? The book may be simple, but the mind that created it is convoluted. Is there another question? Yes?
If there's a damage to free trade, then how do we get from here to there? The second thing is, if it doesn't happen here, if we don't have free trade in the United States, is there another place that's like to get it? The third thing is, okay, if we don't get to utopia,
Well, I mean, look, the answer is yes. One of the problems is if you don't have free trade, you will be out of the loop. One of the big problems with respect to this market is that you import to export, right? And what they do is they impose various tariffs on the import, and then you're going to ship these things off into an export market. And by crippling your imports, you cripple your exports. And the way in which the learned folks say is what we'll do is we'll give you a refund at the exit door for the stuff that came at the entry door. But then, of course, it turns out you mix your inventory and you don't know whether it's the same piece that has to go out or a piece of the same type that has to go out, and now you have to keep segregated supply lines in order to be able to meet the quota stuff. So the answer is, when you're trying to figure out what happens is, if you screw up your export markets because you screw up your import markets, right, people will find a way to just avoid you entirely. Instead of going from Japan to the United States to Singapore, they'll go by way of Taiwan or Australia. So that, you know, we can be out of the cycle very quickly, and that's something which we don't want to do. And one of the real costs of protection is the transactions we don't get to litigate because they simply migrate to somewhere else. The second is, what can ordinary citizens do? I think what they have to do is to give the raspberry every time they start to hear the protectionist line coming forward with respect to the particular benefits that it promises to a particular community. My rule about this is, unless you're prepared to state a proposition on free trade or its restriction to the entire universe of people in the United States, you should never be allowed to play it to that select audience which thinks it's got a short-term benefit. This is a classic problem in which the concentration of benefits from a trade restriction may be palpable and the diffuse set of benefits may be difficult to manage. And the reason why you're so worried about the economic theory about this is it allows you to have strong instincts about the size of diffuse benefits, which will lead you to the conclusion that they're larger than the concentrated benefits that you get from protection. That is, the diffuse benefits of free trade swamp the rest of the system. So I think what people have to do is to change their mindsets about this. It's very hard to get it to do. What ought judges to do? They ought to become hard-hearted. I'm looking at the two of them there. And they have to understand that when victims come before them pleading for restraint, what they have to do is to be a very disciplined parent and say, no, I have other children whom I have to look at afterwards as well. It cannot be that when you decide individual cases, you simply look at the gains and the losses of the individual litigants in complete ignorance of the circumstances and the broader consequences of the decision at hand. And in fact, it seems to me that the single hardest thing about judging, and you know, and I've never been a judge, and I could tell you with my views, I dare say I never will be a judge, is the ability to make the transformation. Are you pleased by that? Shakes hand. Oh, God, keep Epstein off that bench now. Is that the ability to understand that when you're looking at an ex post dispute, you have to figure out what the ex ante effects are. That is, when you look at a dispute after the race has been run, you have to figure out how it's going to influence the next race that's going to take place. And the only thing that we can do as academics is to constantly remind people that the set of relevant consequences are often broader than those that either of the two litigants come before a court are going to be prepared to present. So I think there are things that you can do. And I mean, I'm in the talking business. As somebody said, I'm a member the chattering classes, and it's just a hope that if you get this thing out, it will essentially favor those who believe that the way in which you do success by the world is to do success by yourself in selling them goods rather than in shutting them down. And if you have that open and more expansionist attitude, I think in the long term it could make a very different and powerful impact upon the way a system works. But it is absolutely crazy to think that a coherent set of legal rules in the judiciary or in the legislature will be able to sustain themselves in the face or in the teeth of a popular culture that repudiates the positions that you're talking about. I mean, it's said a long time ago from Colonel Dooley that every judge is influenced by the election returns. We know that's true about legislators, but it's even true of judges and academics. And so therefore, that's why operations like this become so important, because the way in which you influence public opinion through speech and discourse and argumentation will in the long run shape in indefinable ways the paths that one sees taking place in legislative form. Yes, ma'am?
I'm going to try and word this properly.
Okay, Billy.
I am not anti-free trade, but coming from the property industry, I have a serious question to ask you, which is, when we're looking at free trade with animals,
yeah,
and we have an instance with NAFTA where we have cattle that are presumably coming up from other countries by way of Mexico, and we hear one thing, but some countries that are looking at wanting to come here that have an incredible disease like open mouth that would be so hard to keep out of the country.
You remember what I said about the quarantine laws? But I said, in effect, they're terrible when they're abused. That is, when it turns out you claim hoof and mouth disease for animals that are as pure as your own. The right answer to that is never to poo-poo the consideration and to regard it as irrelevant. This is a real externality. This is a tort, as we say. And to the extent that in the domestic market, you could kill animals that are likely to spread those diseases to others or to order them quarantined, exactly that policy ought to take place with respect to the international markets. So that if you're worried about the price of good beef undercutting yours, you don't have my sympathy. If you're worried about the contamination of your crops or even the destruction of a market which says we won't buy any beef because some of it's been contaminated, then I'm very much with you. And what that requires, and it's something which I'm sorry to say I think this country has lost sight of, is you have to have, even in a relatively small trade environment, a non-political, technically astute professional services in order to man the inspection operation. If you don't have that, you're going to be lost, because the moment the service itself becomes unqualified, incompetent, or not focused on its mission, right, it turns out you're going to have both sorts of complaints simultaneously. One, that it's letting in a bunch of cattle which it ought to keep out, and two, that it's keeping out a bunch of cattle that it ought to let in. And I think that in my professional life, which I guess now runs not as long as Judge Moss, but, you know, 28 years and so forth, I think the single largest feature of public life that bothers me the most is I no longer have any confidence in the independence and the integrity of too many of the administrative agencies that are charged with these tasks. I think what happens is it used to be technical expertise used to drive politics. Now I think it's much more likely that politics will drive technical expertise. And for, with respect to the question that you're talking about real torts. You don't have to be delicate in the way in which you express the problem. But what happens is we have to be able to figure out how to provide the injunctive relief, which is neither too narrow on the one hand nor too broad on the other. And that requires an immigration and naturalization service, which is rather a customs service, which may be rather better than the one we have. This, by, oh, I'll stop because I have another spear. Yeah?
Since you mentioned the immigration and naturalization service, I was wondering if you could extend your argument for free trade.
This has become an infinitely more complicated problem, and let me explain to you why it is. In the simplest way in which you put it, when you import goods into your country from another country, they don't vote. When you import immigrants from another country into your country, they do vote, they do receive welfare benefits, and so forth. How do I therefore think about this? This is an issue on which, if you're not conflicted, my view is you do not understand the nature of the problem. I mean, the first thing I would want to mention is, you know, I'm not an immigrant myself, but I'm second-generation American, and as I always like to point out, and indeed mentioned in the Simple Rules book, I would have been born in Warsaw 2 days before the Warsaw Ghetto went up in flames, and I don't think I would have had much of a chance as a two-day-old against that kind of a Holocaust. So, I mean, when you start talking about immigration, I basically owe the survival of my family to the policies of immigration which allowed them to come here around the turn of the century. This is not a small consideration. What is clear to me is that the rise of the welfare state and the decline or the closing of the immigration borders are not unrelated. That is, if you believe, as I do, in the good libertarian society, which tends to have relatively little by way of state redistribution, then every time you admit a citizen to this country, you're telling them that they're going to have to contribute their fair share to the common expenses, and that they will be better off in virtue of their own labor, and we will be better off in virtue of their labor, because they will basically expand the free trade zone inside the United States. So that immigration in a world in which you have sound political Jeffersonian, if you will, institutions, seems to me something that we ought to welcome and ought to place no barriers against it. And indeed, in the period between, say, 1850 and 1920, when we were pretty much a small government operation and we had free immigration, exactly that model seemed to work. But the moment you introduce a system where, in effect, the nature of the goods that are going to be distributed by government will switch depending upon who the electorate is. That is, who's going to get the windfall and who's going to bear the burden in the world of redistributivist politics, then everybody starts to say that the folks whom you admit are not only going to be workers, but they're going to be voters. And by voting, they can take from you everything that you have. So that if you find yourself in a position where you think that you could no longer maintain as a political minority the prerogatives that you have as a political majority, you're going to be necessarily opposed to it. And this is, to me, one of the terrible costs of the modern welfare state. What it does in effect by guaranteeing certain kinds of political redistribution within the polity is it makes it impossible for independent advancement by hard labor for individuals who are outside the country. Not 100%, obviously, because we have some quotas. And so given the current requirement, the hard question is exactly whether you think the productive impulse or the redistributivist impulse in both wealth and political power tends to dominate in a world in which you had smaller governments and less degrees of immigration. You would be, I think, very much more in favor of open immigration policy. How open? Goes back to the things that she mentioned, which was the whole question about quarantine. Any one of you, if you've never done it, should do it. Go to Ellis Island sometime, and you will understand that the quarantine issue was as important with respect to people as it was with respect to animals. They inspected your eyes, they gave you various kinds of tests, and they wouldn't let you in if you carried a contagious disease. But they didn't slaughter you. In fact, at Ellis Islands, they maintained long-term detention centers, which gave you a month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months in some cases, so that you could be rid of your disease and then be able to enter the country in question. And the odd thing when you look at those exhibits is you, for whatever reason, in a world without any judicial review, without any 14th Amendment protections or whatever it is, had more confidence in the accuracy of those administrative determinations than you would have with respect to administrative determinations today. And therein, it seems to me, is something of the tragedy. Okay, one more question, David, and then we'll have to stop. Yes?
Your idea of mutual voluntary exchange seems to be founded on the concept of subjective value theory. And do you think that the subjective value theory trivializes this whole argument people have about trade imbalances?
Well, that's a different sort of argument. No, subjective value, it seems to me, an individual case, is basically says, so long as you have consent and so long as you can negate external coercion, you don't have to worry about the value of the trade to the individual parties. They will protect themselves to the extent that they see fit. When you start to worry about aggregate phenomena like trade imbalances and so forth, you're not necessarily trying to focus on individual exchanges. And you have to ask the question as to whether or not there's some kind of a regulatory restraint on the way in which capital flows back and forth across borders that should lead to trouble. If it turns out you had basically an unregulated market, to the extent that you had a trade imbalance, you could simply describe that as the fact that those individuals who have the least favorable balance of trade have simply received an investment in capital from overseas, and that ought to be nothing to worry about whatsoever, because you could certainly have firms that borrow and firms that lend, and both of them could be solvent. So in a world without regard to the huge mechanizations that we now have at the border, I think the answer is don't worry about that stuff, because it will all come out through the correct sort of processes. But in the current situation, once you have all sorts of currency restraints and other restrictions, when you start to look at a trade imbalance, it may signal that there's something wrong with the regulatory system, even though there's nothing wrong with the logic of contract. Because remember, the difficulty is when you get a bad set of regulations, it's going to induce a crummy set of contracts. It's not that you want to punish the contracts, you want to change the regulation that induces their rather distorted nation. Okay, I think that I see the master of ceremonies is sending me on my airplane. Yes, thank you again.
Thank you, Richard. Before you leave, I failed to mention earlier that for those of you in the legal profession, the luncheon is approved for the minimum continuing legal education for those interested in completing the forms. They're at the front table on the right. Also, Richard has very kindly offered to autograph copies of his books for those of you who don't have copies. Simple Rules for a Complex World is the one, of course, he's been referring to in his talk, which is extremely worth getting. And his classic book, Takings, we also have the softcover edition. I want to thank everyone again for joining with us and making our luncheon a great success, and we look forward to seeing you at our next event. Thank you for coming.